Hi, this is Father Bill W. here in Austin, Texas, and I would like to welcome you to the podcast. I am an Episcopal priest in long-term recovery from alcoholism and a few other addictions as well. Most of us usually don't suffer just from one thing. And the purpose of these podcasts is to try to explore some of the early history of AA and also to dive a little bit deeper into the psychology and the spirituality of our 12-step program. I would encourage you to visit our website. It's called Two Way Prayer, TWO, Two Way Prayer. And there you will learn a little bit about the AA early practice of prayer and meditation. Also a place where you can sign up for the newsletter and check out the events section. It's a calendar for upcoming workshops. And please feel free to write me at twowayprayer@gmail.com. If you have suggestions for any future shows or books you'd like to hear discussed, I'm wide open to that. Or if you'd like to help us with some of the upcoming workshops, to download those flyers, pass them out to your friends in recovery, that would be a great help. And last but not least, I do want to always thank our donors. Two-Way Prayer is totally nonprofit, and for me, I get nothing out of this other than education, and it's a way for me of giving back what was very freely given to me by so many people over a good many years now. So coming close to 50, working my way toward it. My guest is Paul S. He was formerly living in Hong Kong and then Singapore. And now he makes his home in Barcelona, Spain. Paul is the author of a great, great book. I've been promoting the hell out of it. And it is titled, We Agnostics, How William James Advanced a Spiritual Solution to Addiction. And the beauty of it is that James is difficult reading sometimes. His footnotes can go on for two or three pages. And myself and many people in the program said, yeah, it's important. And we tried to read it, but we couldn't get into the depths of it. And Paul took the time to break it down and kind of line it up step by step with where the big book is taking us, as well as the 12 and 12 and some of the other AA literature. I think it's really important. People who have gotten a copy, they've written me and told me it's really been very educational for them. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
See you. I am sorry to see this series coming to an end.
Me too.
Yeah, it's been enlightening and fun. You know, we are not a glum lot. So you've helped bring some liveliness and zest. We're going to be discussing zest later in this episode, but I could feel the zest, and that's really important. So, in this episode, what I want to cover are some of the points from your book that are related to step 12, and then I want to spend the remainder of our time looking at James's own concluding remarks to his lectures, so let's start with the 12-step piece first, and when we talk about step 12, you know, I sometimes wonder if we oftentimes don't jump a little bit too quickly into the part about working with others, and we kind of skip over the first part about having had a spiritual experience first and then awakening, and the real significance of that. And to me, that's one of the things that James really links in very tightly in his lectures. So you think I'm right in that a little too quick to running out helping other people, and maybe not the focus, sufficient focus on what happens internally. What is this spiritual experience?
Yeah, that's so true. And then in fact, you know, what I do when I work with people, there's a really beautiful, the first 2 to 3 pages of step 12 in the 12 and 12 is, I think, some of the most beautiful stuff in all the literature, because it says, this is what we're trying to achieve. what we're trying to achieve is getting to the point where we are going to start helping other people. But before we do that, we need, that's the phraseology about, we need to be a friend among friends. We need to be a worker among workers. We need to be right-sized. We need to have a sense of equanimity and peace of mind with the world. And that's what the first three pages of step 12 is all about. And too often we skip that. That is the first thing I do when I work with people is we're going to read the first three pages of step 12 because that is what everything is about. And then, right, we can see where this other stuff feeds in. So I agree.
I think what I'm getting out of James is it's a natural flow. Mm-hmm. It isn't so much even work, you know? I mean, you get the impression, well, we got to go out there and help people because it's going to help me. And I guess at times that's certainly true. But if I've really done the work, there's a natural flow.
Exactly. I see your point. Yeah. And not only that, Bill, but there's two other elements that come out of this. One is that we should never think about service to others as an obligation. That is wrong because this outflow of a desire to help others is seen as a joy. We get to do this, as I often hear, right, from people who I respect, is we get to help others. And then the second part of it is that we don't help others in order to get some reward down the line, right? In fact, William James, in the postscript of the book, he's very clear. You know, you and I talked about this before we aired here. William James was really clear. The kingdom of God is at hand, right? Give us today our daily bread, right? This is a two-day thing. We are not doing this for some sort of reward in the future in heaven. We're doing it today because there is a joy in doing it as the natural outgrowth of a spiritual experience.
Right.
Very clear about that. And that's that grates on the Protestant ethic and the Catholic ethic, you know, about, you know, sacrifice and service. You know, the sacrifice is seen as creating joy. Joy is the outcrop of this sacrifice. It's not sacrifice for its own sake. And so he has a very different view on a lot of this. And he makes it very clear in the postscript after the book is finished with a lot of grumpy, bitchy commentary he got. from people who were present at the lectures.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of takes theologians to task a bit.
Amen. Yeah.
Here's a nice quote in this chapter. He says, if these things, referring to psychic changes, etc., do not have any connection to our lives, who cares if God's attributes are true or false? What matters, is how I adapt my actions to a belief in a higher power. If these ideas about God have no practical meaning in our lives, all the books proving God's existence may be committed to flames. We must have a study worthy of serious people. And when he said serious people, I wrote in the margins, sick souls who have to have this spiritual experience. I mean, if we don't have this experience, we die. You know, the addiction is going to kill us. So it's absolutely critical. Yeah.
And that the people who are trying to understand what's going on with the sick souls that they tend to, right, or that they are shepherding, whatever, that they can clearly understand that they're just not, you know, going to be pontificating in the pulpit about, you know, silly nonsense that has no relevance to people's, you know, remember we talked about that, you know, God is great and the world is, everything is right with the world. And what's the matter with you? I mean, this is the worst kind of silliness for a sick soul, you know?
Yeah. I knew there was something wrong with me real early. Those bliss ninnies, you know, I didn't know what was wrong with them, but I figured something was, and it was good. I got to be a counselor, and I could always find something wrong with those people. So,
and of course, there's the old saying, you know, there's good Christianity and there's good religion. And if you want to spout good religion, this is not very useful to people who are sick souls who need real, you know, right from the gutter, William James stuff, you know, and so William James having very much claiming to be a sick soul, you know, knew of what he was speaking.
One of the sections in this part of the book talks about the saints and, you know, what it is that they have to teach us. And of course, the big book says we are not saints, you know, but James says this, the saints, with their extravagant human tenderness, may seem preposterous, yet they are impregnators of the world, vivifiers and animators of potentialities of goodness, which but for them would lie forever dormant.
No, it's beautiful language, beautiful
language.
Isn't that
beautiful?
Yeah, yeah.
But tell us what it means.
Well, it's something that you said too. I think that your approach is wonderful too. I think you and I were talking about this a lot, you know, in our breaks and before, is that when you got cleaned up and to me, it's a certain extent in LA in the men's group, there was like, you know, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, yeah, and put it in your mouth and do what you're told and shut up and show up early and clean the ashtrays and, you know, don't talk, you know, and I think that's just a lot of bullshit, you know, and so I think that there's a lot to be said for tenderness and gentleness in the way that people really tune in and say, and come to in terms of, you know, getting the message. I think it's really important.
And that really becomes the program of attraction.
Exactly.
Yeah, see it in them and cannot recognize it in us. Even I'd go further, deny that it exists in us.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, an inability to recognize it and an outright denial that it's even possible. Because that was me. I was dead on the inside. I was dead on the inside. I'm telling you right now. Yeah. And also, you know, there's something else too, you know, that you know, and William James makes a really good human insight. He says that we are, as a human race, we are attracted to the strong man. We're attracted to the tyrant to lead us and to make decisions for us and to create a tribe. And sometimes we want to pluck the beard of the saint and poke him and make fun of them. And yet. It's also profound human nature to see the elegance and the wisdom of the gentleness and the silence.
That's why there's, I don't want to get political here, but just briefly, there's a real rise in autocrats all over the world. All over the world.
Yep.
You know, I'm the tough guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, I was just really tuning into that when I got to this part of the book.
Yeah, the autocrats will love to go after the people who are lost souls, because those lost souls are looking for somebody who will tell them what to do.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of lost souls in the world right now because of the economic disruption from the GFC and COVID and many other things that are happening right now. And so that you're right. I mean, I think there is a human tendency to want to go for the tyrant, for the strong man to tell us what to do. But at the same time, I think there's also a very strong human element of admiring the silent, the gentle giant is also worthy of admiration.
And what is true in our projections outward, I believe, is also true for us at those times when this thing becomes too difficult. And I say, oh, the hell with it. And I just steamroll over somebody.
Yeah.
I become the bully.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
That's in us too. It's not only in them, it's also in us. And so it's like, you know, which wolf are you going to feed?
And so often the way that we, you know, talk to others is exactly the way that we talk to ourselves, you know.
That's right. Yeah. So, score a few points for the Saints there, according to James, you know. But what he says is what's in them is also in us. So don't just put them on the pedestal. See what it is that they have gotten a hold of and that also exists in the last place we'd ever look for it, and that's within ourselves.
Yeah, so true, so true. It's a good way to put it.
That's what I hear him saying.
And at the same time, you know, William James was a shrewd man himself. You know, you don't get to be a tenured professor at Harvard, you know, if you're not shrewd. Right. And so he's saying, look, at, you know, we are not, the world is not full of saints. So if you want to be a saint all the time and to all people, you're a fool.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
you got to be able to have enough, you know, it's the serenity prayer thing. You got to be able to know what you're going to have to pick your fights here and pick your battles. And then, you know, gentleness will work, but just be careful because there's a lot of, and it's William James's language. The world is full of boa constrictors and alligators and robbers and thieves and bandits, right? Those are the words he uses.
Yeah.
And so we need to be careful and not be sort of a jackass. Charlie Curran, when I was at Catholic University of America, Charlie Curran, he was a very famous theologian who was dismissed by the Cardinal Hickey of Washington, D.C. He was fired because he was too liberal. He said, you know what? We are called to be fools for Christ's sake, not fools for Christ's sake. You know? I love that. I think that perfectly sums up William James's view about, look at, you know, there is a time for rebellion and there's a time for civil disobedience,
right.
But there's also a time for gentle silence and, elegant approaches to things. So I like that. He wasn't, you know, completely single-minded on this.
Right. So let's go ahead and turn now to James's concluding chapter. It's chapter 20. If anybody has the varieties of religious experience, you can turn to chapter 20, and it's then the 20th lecture that he delivered there in Edinburgh. I started reading that concluding chapter this week, and I got to tell you, I came upon what he gives as a summation, and he does it in five short lines. And I went back to that every morning in my quiet time and read it and went deeper and deeper into the depths of what this guy is getting to. And I think it's the most beautiful summation of his book and also of the program that I've come across. So
yeah,
let me read it. We will, and I'm putting it in the show notes. So that you can look at it yourself and study it. But this is how he starts off. He says, summing up in the broadest possible way, the characteristics of the religious life, the spiritual life, the AA life, whatever you want to call it, these characteristics include the following beliefs. One and two, I'm going to join them together because they flow. One, that the visible world is part of a more spiritual universe from which it draws its chief significance. And two, that union or harmonious relation with the higher universe is our true end. I want to break this down, Paul, because I just think it's vital. So that the visible world, the ego world, the usual world that we're all so accustomed to living in and coming from. I mean, that's the center of our energy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That it's part of a more spiritual universe from which it draws its significance. So if I'm not drawing my significance from it, I'm already going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, yeah. William James talks about wealth and he doesn't do any commas. Wealth and pomp and power. And you know, Bill Wilson talks about money, property, and prestige.
Right.
And those are the things that so many of us get wrapped up in. And God knows I was wrapped up in that in my 20s and 30s, in working in banks in Hong Kong and in Tokyo and other places. And London.
I have other friends who are out there robbing those banks, you know?
Yeah. I wish them well.
Oh, I do too.
No, I'm kidding. And so it's soul destroying. And yeah, my soul was just ripped apart. You know, I just felt like I was somebody had opened my soul with like a rusty can opener, and I had one little tiny part left before it was about to fall off. And so I it took me a long time. It took me several years to figure this out before I got cleaned up. And I think that's right. And yet it's very, very difficult because you're looking at walking away from the potentiality of, well, the security that money offers. And I think that's an illusion because no matter how much money you have, you always want more. No matter how much power you have, you always want more. No matter how much pomp you have, you want more. And so nothing's enough. And I know, I
mean, that's the nature of addiction, isn't it? I mean, that's
I just wonder if it's the nature of human life that we are.
Well, we're all addicts.
we have this desire for, you know, more. And the kind of false security that wealth offers and the exclusion you seem to think you get from other people's suffering when you have that wealth, and yet wealth doesn't save us from suffering. This is what I see all the time.
Yeah. And so that we have to be drawing our strength, our energy, our meaning, ultimately, from this higher source. Because this is a second line, that union or harmonious relation with that higher universe is our true end. We're meant to be we have to be in relationship to this other, to this more, to this higher power, you know, call it what you will. I got to serve somebody. And if I wind up not serving that higher cause, that good cause, look out, because I'm going to serve some other intention that will destroy me in the end.
I struggle with that line a lot. I remember when I was writing the book, I'm just like, is that a bridge too far for me? I mean, is my only true end this harmonious relation with this higher power? And I knew somehow it to be true, but wait a minute here. Do I have to give up this other stuff? You know,
No.
God make me chaste, but not yet.
Right.
Well, St. Augustine said, yeah, I'll get there. Just not right now. Not yet. And so, this is that radical, view that William James has, right? Now, fair enough. This is the guy who was probably 62 when he did these lectures. And he'd already written like the preeminent book on psychology. He'd written five other books. He'd become a tenured professor. He'd taught in three departments. You know, that's would be impossible today. I mean, not like unlikely, impossible. Right. He taught in philosophy. He taught in psychology. He taught in medicine. He basically established the School of Medicine at Harvard. Did the pomp and power of his family and his ambition get him to where he was? Is there an evolution to this? I asked Bill, question mark. I don't know.
Well, Jung said it in a way that was very helpful to me, that in the first half of life, there are a set of rules that we live by. And part of those are the building up of self, becoming somebody, earning a way in the world, all of that sort of stuff. And you get a lot of good boy for that, which is helpful. But then in the second half of life, the rules change. And if I'm still at that point searching for the more, never satisfied with what I have, then I've missed it. because now the rules have changed. Now,
yeah, I like it. I like it.
Yeah, the time of letting go, of letting go. So you don't get a seven-year-old kid to, you know, hey, let go of that.
Yeah. Or even a 17-year-old or a
17 or a 20. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there an expiration date on that first half? Is there anything on that?
It's a movable feast. I've found people in the program at 17 and 18. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, in the gay world, I am telling you, it's uncanny. The gay men sort of crawl into 12-step programs normally between 35 and 37 years old.
Is that right? Yeah.
It's just like clockwork. They come in between 35 and 37. Their lives don't work. They had the big house. They had the house instead of the children, and the gym membership and the boyfriends and all that jazz. And then it just wasn't enough, right? And the clubs and the drinking and the beach, the summer beach, you know, house, and it's just all nonsense. And so it's really uncanny. Between 35 and 38 max, I would say 80% of the gay men tend to trip into AA. But I think what's happening now is crystal methamphetamine is bringing everybody in earlier because it's such an evil drug. It's such a bad drug. It gets people in the rooms quicker.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we get to go up till we've gone down.
True. And I think it's a beautiful, beautiful line. It's extremely powerful. And I do believe it. If you ask me right now and nail me down, I would say I believe it. I just, I'm getting there. I'm trying to get there.
Well, we're all trying to get there. Yeah, we're all trying to get there. You know, and there's a part of us that's there. And this is what I'm taking away from James. And there's a part of us that's not there.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I gravitate around the part that's not there, I can always go back into the darkness. My sick soul, is always there for the waiting and, inviting me. Let's go on here because
But one thing I want to say though, is that. I just found it by total accident. Steve Allen said one of the most beautiful things. He said, some of us observing that ideals are rarely achieved proceed to the error of considering them worthless. Such an error is greatly harmful. True north cannot be reached either, since it is an abstraction, but it is of enormous importance. And that's as all the world's travelers can attest. There is a true north, but there isn't. Yes, it's a true end, but if we dismiss it because it's impossible, that's silly. In the same way that true north is dismissing that is also silly. It has a role to play. It's something to aim for. And so I'll go for that. I'm all there.
Well, that's my understanding of step 6 and 7. It's the only thing that made sense for me, that you aim for perfection, but settle for progress.
Yeah. I don't know anybody else personally who has as much sobriety as you. And when you really get better, my mentor said you get better at like 40 years sobriety and he only had 36. So are you going to say like 55, you get better?
72, 72 years sober, but I'm heading towards it, Paul.
Okay. Right. 72. I'll hold you.
We'll check back with me. item number 3. And this one I really love. Prayer or inner communion with the spirit thereof, this God or whatever we're going to call it, be that spirit God or law. So this inner communion with this is a process wherein work is really done and spiritual energy flows in and produces effects, psychological or material, within the phenomenal world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of words there, but worth spending some time to break it down. I guess we were kind of getting to that there is business. And that's the word that, we have business with one another.
Yeah.
This God has business with us. We have business with this God. we have business with this true north, if you will, you know, to carry that analogy, you know, because if I don't set my compass towards that, I'm going to go off, you know. So there really is work to be done. And this is important. And spiritual energy flows in. Yeah, when I'm in right relationship with this source, capital S, I feel it. I feel this flow into my spirit from the other spirit. And there's a connection. And that
I'm able to do things now that were seemingly impossible one day ago. So
you start with step one, I'm hopeless. Yeah. And you look to step 12, there's even more than hope, you know, there's transformation. And now, like what you're saying, now I'm able to do what I couldn't do before.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of the steps. And my experience is people get lost in the steps, like they get lost in religion, playing around the edges and missing the central core, the hot core that I have to get in touch with. You following me? Yeah.
I know you do. Indeed. And even Bill Wilson calls it like a new source of propulsion. I really like that phraseology that he uses, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something allows me to do something that I thought was impossible before. So I quit smoking with the steps. I changed my relationship with food using the steps. You know, I stopped drinking with the steps. Right. Al-Anon has helped me immensely with my very dysfunctional family, which is my family of origin. So there's been immense sources of strength. And I've had to sit with people who've done horrible things that they're seeking, you know, forgiveness for doing step work with people. And I was just excruciatingly uncomfortable. But it's like, do this and something good will come out of this. Don't worry about it. Just keep listen and shut your mouth and something good will come out of this. And you would not believe the goodness that has come out of horrendous events of brutality and selfishness, of parents to their children, every form of abuse imaginable. And there's been forgiveness and redemption.
That's right.
So man, oh man, that the force of the steps in step four and five in particular, that the power of forgiveness is really so key. And I wish people would be much more willing to talk about not just the things that they have done, but the things that they've helped other people negotiate and reconcile with as well. I think that, you know, stealing the milk money is not what William James is talking about here, right?
No.
Because his cases that he mentions in the book were very hardcore people who were not nice people and were terribly addicted and destroyed their lives. And so he's not messing around. We need to be worthy of serious people, like you said.
Yeah, and you know what I was taught when I was just starting out in this if I'm doing a fifth step with somebody or counseling with somebody, don't ever be shocked because it's also in me. It's always also in me. Maybe a different form, maybe a different degree.
Yep.
But I mean, this is the human condition. Yep. And the thing about, and this I really underlined in this chapter, is there's that goodness in everybody too.
Yep.
You got to see that. You got to see it.
Yep.
Maybe.
And William James goes back to this all the time. We are all made of the same cloth.
Right.
We all come from the same clay. We're all the same.
That's right.
And nobody is beyond redemption. Every single person, no matter what they've done, is worthy of redemption. He's very emphatic about that. And that sure must have, you know, irked some of the audience as well.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, Bill, you know, this is that thing where we talked about this a lot. He says, hey, you know what? If this is spiritual, it's great. This could also be a psychological or like an element of phenomenology. It could be a phenomenon.
That's right.
We don't know. But you know what? If it's spiritual, it's better. That's all I can say. And that you illuminated me to the idea that is exactly why all of us are agnostics. We don't know.
Yeah.
But it's better if it's spiritual. That's all he's willing to say. And right. I'm okay with that. I think that's great.
A little more light on the path.
Yeah.
More light.
Yeah.
Let me go to number four. I like this one a lot. So what's the fruits of this connection with this higher power? A new zest, Z-E-S-T, which adds itself like a gift to life and takes the form either of lyrical enchantment or of appeal to earnestness and heroism. Now, if you're going to fly through William James, you will miss the depth of this sentence. I mean,
And he's a very funny guy. A lot of fun. He had a lot of fun doing these lectures. He was very, edgy and bitchy and hey, ha ha, look what I got for you coming up. And by the way, I tried nitrous oxide and it's pretty cool.
Right. Yeah.
and also notice how he says, he's very clear about this. It brings zest. It doesn't make you a zealot. Zealots are insufferable. Stop it. Don't do that. That's the worst kind of saints are the zealous, over the top people. He says, that's not what this is about.
I'm not that much of a cook, but if I ever follow a recipe well, and it talks about adding the zest of a lemon or the zest of an orange. I mean, I no longer skip that. It's an important part of the recipe. And right. So you scrape that skin and damn, it changes the whole outcome. Right. The zest. And this is the thing I'm convinced that alcoholics and addicts have got to find. If you're going to try to attach yourself to a dead AA group or a dead church or a dead program, you ain't going to get the zest.
Yeah.
And if you don't get the zest, you're going to go looking for it somewhere else.
That's right. It's a great adventure. And that's, this book I do every day called Touchstones by Hazelden. It's a meditation for men. I love it. And the guy at the beginning in the introduction, he said, we don't even know who this guy is, but he said, I've been sober for a long time. I think he was more than 30 years sober. He said, it took me a long time. And in this second edition of what I'm doing, we have got to pay attention to the fact that the journey of sobriety is a great adventure. If we don't see it as a great adventure, we're missing something. And I think I'm really glad that you bring this up. And then, lyrical enchantment. What a great phraseology as well. I just love it.
Right. Break. Let's play with that for a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. So this zest, it adds it to life, and it comes in various forms. So these are the forms he says it comes in, and the first one is lyrical enchantment, poetry, music, jogging. They take on a spiritual dynamic to them, a consciousness of connectedness that was not there before. The world was flat and dry and lifeless. And now the lyrical enhancement, the music, is starting to come back into my life. Really important.
Yep. So true. Really. And like you said, it's... I've written a book of poetry. I've written 7 books since I cleaned up. I have, I've done so many different things. I've gotten back in shape again. I run every day. But this book of poetry that I wrote about my family of origin and my own, journey about sexual abuse when I was a boy, it was extremely potent and liberating for me. And I never thought I could get it in poetry. And guess what? You do, right? And so that's right. And so analytical work is just as good as music and poetry, And by the way, I sponsored a guy and he was great. He was African-American from LA. Mm-hmm. And he decided to write out his fifth step as a rap music. And I was like, more power to
go
him.
Go for it.
And he did beautiful, beautiful stuff. And he was under felony rap for crystal methamphetamine distribution. And he, I don't know what happened to him, But he it was very good stuff, and you know, we come at this all different ways.
Right. Yeah. A new earnestness and heroism. So there's back to the spirit, the hero's journey that I think maybe he references here. When I hear the stories of people coming up from nothingness and brokenness, and yet they not only survive, they thrive. You know, there was a woman, I got sober in Detroit, and she had lost two daughters in a fire. She didn't have any kids after that. Black woman. And I was talking with her one night, and she, you know, it's like, how do you do it? You know, and she said, "Oh, Bill, I have 100 daughters now."
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And she did, but she wasn't just saying it, Paul. She did. She was mother to 100 women. And the heroism
I like it.
Of that.
Yeah, we see those stories all the time about people who they claim new families, they claim new sense of purpose.
Right.
When I got cleaned up and I heard stories at the beginning, I was like, I was blown away by how honest and earnest people were about the humility they had about these humiliating circumstances, and you know, getting arrested and getting thrown out of the house and you know, disastrous marriages having the humility and terrible things that happened to them as children. I was really, and that's always inspiring when you hear gritty, right from the gutter stuff that, you know, and then the redemption, the deliverance. You know, we haven't used that word a lot in our chatting, and that deliverance from past catastrophe is so remarkable, and it's so admirable in so many stories.
And after a while, it soon becomes an asset.
Yeah, amen. Yeah, you know, it becomes our greatest asset.
Our greatest asset. Maybe the only thing we've got.
I have found that my family of origin, which is basically a catastrophe, has become a great asset because I'm able to help other people who come from, you know, other families that are also catastrophic. You know, I sponsored a guy. His whole family was killed by alcoholism. Every one of his family members. He had 3 siblings and 2 parents, and all 5 died of alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understood where he was coming from.
That's right.
Because I've lost a brother and a father to alcoholism, and I have quite a few other siblings going down the drain. But my family was wiped out by alcoholism before I was born.
Yeah.
That much I know to be true.
Yeah. We share a similar story with that. And he touches on this, I think, in his 5th point. Again, what we derive from this new life, this new connection. He says, and assurance of safety and a temper of peace. And in relation to others, a preponderance of loving affections.
Mm, yeah.
We find a place inside of safety and peace, you know? And he's talking really here about, you know, in large part, prayer and meditation, that maintaining this connection with this source of power and strength and transformation, it brings us into a realm of peace and safety. I find that true, you know, in my morning. That's why
I find it true as well. I find that to be true. I never believed it.
Yeah.
Because it really boils down to one sentence for me. These 5 things as we conclude our time together, you know, is there something out there that I can appeal to that will respond to my personal appeal?
Right.
And the answer is, you know, William James says, we've been writing about this stuff for 4,000 years. Answer, yes. Or else we wouldn't have been writing about this stuff for 4,000 years. If this personal appeal and this response from the universe is a natural sort of hand grenade that comes from the subconscious to the conscious and causes a rearrangement, hallelujah. Right. But we don't know. But if it's a spiritual, event, that's probably better. It's somehow better if it's a spiritual event. And that causes two things to happen. My life gets larger. I feel connected. I feel union. And we get these other things. I love it. Safety and peace. And preponderance, that's a good word.
Isn't that a wonderful word?
Right? Preponderance.
Not that it's there all the time. It's not there all the time. That's what I mean, I kind of meditated on that word. But the majority of the time it's there. And then I get lapses when it's not there. And those become teaching opportunities for me, because I spiral into the darkness yet again. And then, like a beggar, I come back in my prayer and meditation, you know? And what I hear in my two-way prayer is, I've never been yelled at by I listen to Jesus. You know, Jesus, unlike my father, says, well, you dumb little ass, you know? I don't get that. It's very gentle. Did you learn something from that? Are you now ready to go deeper?
Yeah.
That's why that preponderance word, I mean, anybody who tells me they're happy, joyous, and free all the time, you know, I want to say next.
Yeah.
Because you don't have anything to teach me. And right, and I don't think you're in touch with life. It just isn't that way.
And a preponderance, you know, is like, you know, what you see in the courtroom. You see a preponderance of evidence that says something is much more likely to be true than false.
That's right.
And I think that's really a great way to put it, that this is a courtroom, right, decision where there's an awful lot of evidence on one side versus the other. And I like that.
Yeah. So a preponderance of loving affections. I mean,
it's true most of the time.
Yeah.
That's what we get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the time during this day, I didn't want to kill myself or kill somebody else. This is a good day.
Yeah. Well, come on. It's a little more than that,
Bill. Well, I mean, I'm grateful for anything I can get. I mean, I'm diving into this six soul thing with both feet.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I tell you, I had an experience. This goes way back, where I had my daughter with me. I was visiting parents, and she was sleeping with me. She's a young kid in the room, and she cried and woke up, and woke me up. And she did it five times during the course of the night, five times. And on the fifth time, I found within myself the part of me that could be a child abuser to hit her. I had controls. I did not hit her, but I felt that within me, which could.
Yep.
And that was very helpful for me, you know? And ever since then, and God, that was 40 some odd years ago, many more, I've had more compassion for people who didn't have the kind of controls. And I'll tell you this, those controls that I had, they were a gift too, you know?
Yes, sir. No, I get it. I hear you. I've been there, done that with so many people I've worked with. Yeah.
So loving affections. The preponderance of times. And you'll even get to it if you stay with this thing when you're in traffic, you know? And you're going to let the other guy through. Yeah, come on, you know?
Well, I only live in cities where there's no cars, because I am a menace to society. I'm the wheel of a car, and I can't do it well. So,
Well, that's advanced spirituality for sure.
Yeah, I can't live in Los Angeles anymore.
Yeah, we do AA. We're not ready for triple A, you know.
Yeah, I know. That's right. Yeah.
Well, listen, this has been an exciting adventure into the world of William James. Paul, I thank you for writing the book.
Oh, you're so great. I could talk to you all day long. I'm going to see you soon. I hope. I'm going to go to Austin to visit you. And I also got my new higher power here. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
Say hi.
Beautiful.
Yeah. He's 3 months old. And his name is, I named him after my mentor, Bill, because Bill, can you see there's a little bit of a collar in the black?
Yeah.
So I decided to name him after my mentor, Bill. And so his name is Willie. And so he's a really good doggy. And he's already learned to, you know, sleep in his bed.
Is his middle name James? Is his middle name James?
It is.
Good.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Jaime. Well, Jaime. Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you once again, Paul, for your wisdom with us. I think we've all benefited greatly. And I want to thank all of you folks who listened to this series. I think it had some very good lessons. Do check out the show notes on these 5 points that James ends with. And I'd encourage you to kind of take it to your meditation in the morning. Look at that. See how you're doing.
Yeah, it's beautiful stuff. I'm glad you picked that out.
It is beautiful. So, hey, my friend, thank you so much. God bless and keep.